And we're back. Hello, everyone, and thank you for checking back in with us. It's been a while, but this is the Stevie Nicks Hockey Experience. That's right. And a special guest today with me, as always, is my producer, Mike Clarkin, who is already – Mike Clarkin, your production skills have already paid off. I make fun of you for being the quote-unquote producer, but as I'm sure our guests can corroborate, you've actually paid off already getting the Skype set up. So you know what? It's actually not that bad.
Oh, well, thank you for your kind
He's
words.
He's pulling his weight. He's pulling his weight, folks.
All right, so homie, I'll introduce our guest, homie.
I was just about to introduce our guest. This is a first, Mike Clarkin, because not only is this what you call the get for me, this person actually suggested that he is the first person ever to actually suggest to come on the podcast. It was actually his idea. So I'm really happy he did. We got Nick Hirshon, who is an esteemed author and a professor and a media historian. So, first of all, thank you for coming on.
Thanks a lot for having me. I really appreciate it.
And, you're writing, of course, a new book about my beloved Islanders. You're, of course, a big hockey fan, big Islander fan like myself. So, right off the bat, we're getting along great. And, Let me first. Before we get into the book, I want to ask you, what exactly is a media historian?
And that's a good question, I guess. For the history of media is something that is not explored that much by average historians, by your traditional historian. So there is a kind of niche group of people, and I'm part of a group called the American Journalism Historians Association that specifically looks at media history. A lot of it is journalism history in the United States, but it also expands to be TV and radio and almost any entertainment, and not only news and journalism. So that's basically, I got my PhD at Ohio University in 2016 with a focus on media history. And I've tried to publish in a lot of academic journals that go into media history. And that's sort of how I got into this project with the Islanders, which started as my dissertation at Ohio.
Oh, okay. So when you're referring to the project with the Islanders, are you referring to the upcoming book, or are you referring to the Nassau Coliseum book, your first book?
No, the book that I have coming out in December, We Want Fish Sticks, that was my dissertation at Ohio University that I just defended in 2016. And it basically started as everybody who's going for a PhD in that program, in the mass communication program that I was in, you have to pick some topic related to mass comm. And I was struggling because I really wanted to do something relating to sports history because that's my interest area. And I didn't really know how to connect it to mass communication. And then I started thinking about the Fisherman logo and I asked my dissertation director and she said, well, the logo itself is a form of mass communication. And so from there, I was able to explore the crazy zany world of Mike Milbury and Kirk Muller and the John Spano and the Islanders in the mid-90s by looking at the mass communication aspect of the logo.
That's very cool. It's amazing that they let you do that too. And that's actually one of the questions I was going to ask you is how the idea for the book actually came about. So you weren't planning originally to write a book about this, I guess.
No, I mean, actually, I became an Islanders fan a few years after they departed from the Fisherman logo in 1999. And I didn't really know much about its history at all or about those players from that era. But I was searching for topics, and for a dissertation, they say you really got to pick something you're going to love because you're going to be writing a lot about it. You're going to be spending a few years at least talking about it, and probably your whole career, because everyone always asks you in academia, what was your dissertation about? So I was thinking of, like, what would really motivate me? What kind of story would I find interesting? And I'm a fan of the Mets and the Islanders, so I was kind of looking through their history. And then the Fisherman logo just struck me as, you know, I'm a 80s kid, so being someone who, you know, grew up in the 90s, I thought it would be kind of fun to go back and look at that era. I just think the whole story of the Fisherman logo is so funky, and it kind of gets a bad rap sometimes for the right reasons, but also we too easily dismiss it as just this ridiculous logo and don't really ask questions about, well, why did the Islanders do that and what else was going on in the time, kind of looking at the context of it. So that's how it all came about.
Okay. So you missed all of that madness while it was happening.
Yeah, I was not a fan.
So how did you become an Islanders fan?
Basically, every weekend, my parents would take me out to my grandparents' house on Long Island, and they lived in North Merrick. and we would pass by the Coliseum quite often. And then a few times I would ask my dad, like, what happens over there? And he didn't know much about it. It wasn't like he was an Islanders fan either, but he knew something about, oh, yeah, they play hockey out there. And I just thought it was kind of crazy that in this desolate parking lot in the middle of nowhere, Long Island, it seemed at that time to a kid, that they, you know, Wayne Gretzky and all the stars of hockey and Mario Lemieux were coming to play at Nassau Coliseum. And then I just thought that was really cool. And I always like underdogs, and the Islanders at that point were about as underdog as you could get in 1999. And starting to go to the games and just, you know, it was just a fun experience. It's, you know, just going to games in person, hearing the skates against the ice, seeing, you know, all of these great players from the other teams. Unfortunately, again, in that era of the Islanders, there weren't a lot of great players on our team. But it just became a kind of a fun family excursion, and I really got into following them.
Wow. So so I'm a little younger than you. I've been an Islanders fan my whole life, but I remember the Fisherman logo, not well, and certainly not from the perspective that I have now, because I was so young. Me being the quote-unquote millennial or 90s kid or whatever, me and my fucking both, I didn't really know everything that was going on. But of course, being a diehard Islander fan, I later found out about it, and really the things I heard about it was from my dad. My dad is in his 60s now, and he's been an Islander fan since 1972. And he was really the one, especially, you know, when I was old enough to really understand hockey and really know what was going on, he was the one who really explained to me everything that was going on with the Fisherman logo and how people like him and of his generation, especially, who could remember the Stanley Cups, they hated it. They hated the Fisherman logo. And he told me primarily because it replaced the logo that was our tradition.
Right.
So when you were doing your research, I guess, we'll, you know, let's jump into it now. When you were doing the research for the book and you were, you know, gathering all this stuff, is that the feeling that you got? Or what was the feeling you got from people who were around? I know Eric Fischer was writing the forward, which is amazing. I want to ask you about that, too.
Yeah.
But, I mean, what was the general... you know, when it first was introduced in June 1995, what was the general reaction from people who were in and around the Islanders organization?
Well, the logo actually, even before June of 1995 is when they officially unveiled it at a mm-hmm. press conference, but it actually leaked to the media, and it was reported first by the Daily News in April of 1995, and they plastered it on Dennis Potvin. They took the old Islanders logo off Dennis Potvin, and they put the Fisherman logo on it, and they wrote this article that was very snarky and made fun of it, and it looks like Gorton's fish sticks and all that stuff. And I think that that's where it really started to unravel, even before they could get it out to the public, because they couldn't do it on their own terms. The first time the public hears about it is in this comical way. Isn't this a ridiculous-looking logo? And as exactly as you learned from your dad, basically they departed completely from the Islanders' tradition. Instead of introducing this as some sort of a third jersey, which didn't really exist at that time, and it came into play the next season, the third jersey program, they were just eliminating the logo that everyone associated with all of the Stanley Cups and all of the great Islanders players from that era, and replacing it with something that, by different opinions, was either just not up to snuff with what the old logo was, or a complete embarrassment that evoked some sort of a frozen seafood brand.
Yeah. No question. I mean, that's the impression that I got too. And also, I think it is also important to understand the era that this happened in, the mid-90s NHL. That was the first time that anyone had introduced the concept of a third jersey. I think that was the first year they said you can do a third jersey. And jersey sales for especially the expansion teams, like San Jose and Anaheim and Tampa Bay and all these other teams, were way through the roof.
Right.
And I want to ask you about, you know, the infamous Gang of Four, because this was their idea. Do you know whose idea it was specifically to change the logo, or was it just from them?
I really tried to find that out. So at the time, the team was owned by John Pickett, but he was an absentee owner at that point. And as you say, he put the team in charge with these Gang of Four, as they came to be known, these four guys who were minority owners of the team. And it seems like Stephen Walsh, who was one of those four, was the one who most ardently was in favor of the Fisherman logo. I don't want to say that it was his idea, because I really don't think it was his alone. I think it was kind of a groupthink process that took place. There were some rumors that Walsh brought it home to one of his kids and the kid liked it. And so then Walsh, in these future meetings, was basically saying, yep, this is the logo we're going to go with. It's going to appeal to the younger generation of fans. But it just seems like from the very beginning, a lot of different people within the Islanders thought they needed some sort of a brand refreshing. They went with a design firm called SME out of Manhattan, which had done a lot of great hockey designs, including the Florida Panthers most recently before they did the Islanders, and went on to later do the Lady Liberty logo for the Rangers, actually. And the NHL was saying, yeah, this is a great way to get more revenue. The Islanders were in desperate need of revenue because they're at a dilapidated building without star players in a market that's not as big as most of the other NHL locales. So they decided this was going to be a kind of thing that would get them a lot of media attention. They thought rappers on MTV were going to be wearing this sort of jersey. And obviously it never really panned out that way. But, you know, you do have to go back, as you said, at that time with looking at what the sports branding craze was like, because in 1988, Wayne Gretzky is traded to the LA Kings, and it's this big movement in hockey of, wow, maybe if you have the sport's greatest player now suddenly coming from Edmonton into the United States, not only in the United States, but in the second biggest market in the United States, this is really going to reawaken interest in hockey. And the same time that the Kings got Gretzky, they unveiled new jerseys. And from then on, all teams started thinking about, well, maybe we could unveil jerseys. And obviously, when the Sharks came into the league and the Ducks, they had these cartoon logo jerseys that did very, very well. That inspired the Islanders to go with a cartoon. Also, by the time the Islanders did it, though, it was getting a little bit passé. It was already, you know, 5-6 years into this rebranding craze. And the particular things that worked with the Kings, who didn't have a great history like the Islanders did, and the Sharks and the Ducks, who didn't have any history before they came to the league, obviously, that did not really match the Islanders' situation. You know, they had a history that fans still remembered fondly and wanted to evoke in that old logo that was now going out the door.
That's, I'll tell you what, I think Jerry Buss, who was the Kings owner, didn't at Gretzky's press conference joke to the press, he goes, thank you all for witnessing our new jersey unveiling today.
Yeah.
He's largely responsible for that whole thing because he certainly mucked it up and brought it to the attention of everyone.
Yeah. Basically, they make that joke at the beginning of the Gretzky press conference, which you can find on YouTube and everywhere, where he says, oh, yeah, we need some models going to come out to unveil our new jerseys, I think. And then Wayne Gretzky comes out. But even though they were half joking about it, it was a very smart business move because they knew that they were going to sell a lot of Gretzky jerseys. And they also knew that the team was going to be on an upswing. So if you rebrand at a time when the team is about to start winning, people associate that new logo with the winning. And it evokes all those good memories. Another problem with the Islanders was that they unveiled their logo at a time when they had no real reason to believe that they were going to win many games. They didn't have a star player. They just didn't have much going for them at all. So it was not the right time to be changing the jersey. They looked to the jersey as a way to save the franchise. This was going to make so much money that then we can spend on players and renovate the Coliseum. But it usually goes the opposite way. When you're investing a lot of money in the team, when you think you're about to win, when you just signed a star player, that's actually the time that you should probably unveil a new jersey.
So it's interesting that you said that the NHL kind of encouraged them to use the logo change as a way of making more revenue, because it also, I got the impression from different things that I've read about, you know, the Spano fiasco, was that the NHL also pushed Pickett and the Gang of Four to try to, you know, look at John Spano as a potential owner. Do they serve some kind of blame in that, or is that just a bad ideas and decision making by the Islanders management?
I mean, I think all around there's a lot of blame to be shared, and one of the troubling things with these kinds of cases is that, you know, people do start to think there's one guy who's responsible and we've got to riot and get that guy. And it really isn't that case. There were many different people involved, and a lot of them very intelligent, very well-intentioned people, but just you know, sometimes things don't work out. And with Spano, I think basically the league thought that the Islanders were vetting him. The Islanders thought the league were was vetting him. Banks thought that attorneys were vetting. Everybody thought someone else was the one in charge of figuring out, was he the real deal? And it just became this absurd mess. So certainly the NHL played a role in that. And John Pickett wanting to sell the team very quickly and kind of overlooking some of the suspicious things that were going on with Spano. And the same thing with the logo. I think it was just a lot of people wanted to change stuff with the Islanders, and they were so desperate for some sort of a refreshing that they didn't ask all the questions that they should have. They really didn't do any research process, because you would think if they did some fan interviews, focus group testing, lots of people would have said, oh, that's the Gorton's Fisherman. And immediately they would have trashed this logo. But when you don't do that, and when you have some of the owners coming into meetings, as I have heard it described by people who were at those meetings, but if you have someone like Stephen Walsh go into a boardroom and say, hey guys, what do you think of this logo? I think it's awesome. What are you going to say? That's your boss. That's the owner of the team. That's the guy who, you know, who decides whether you get a raise or whether you're going to stay employed by the Islanders. So you're not going to contradict him. You're going to go along with it. And unfortunately that led to all these issues.
Yeah. Going back to the Islanders ownership at the time, I've heard stories. I mean, the Islanders made the conference final 2 years before. It's really amazing how quickly they fell off.
Yeah.
And a lot of that was because I've heard that they Ray Ferraro went to free agency, was their leading scorer the previous year. They had traded away Glenn Healy. A lot of guys went out the door that shouldn't have left. I mean, the Turgeon trade for Kirk Muller is also a great example of that. Is it a fair assessment to call them the Gang of Four again? Is it a fair assessment to call them cheap, and that they were looking for just a quick way to make a buck, or then they looked at the Islanders as more of a way to easy way to make money instead of really running a team properly? Is it fair to say that they really didn't have the Islanders' best interest at heart?
I don't know if that's really true with the Gang of Four, because you got to remember they are minority owners. So even if, you know, they didn't have real estate rights, they were not looking for the sorts of things that came up with later Islanders owners. I really think they were well-intentioned guys who just were kind of clueless about the Islanders' history and didn't understand how much that logo resonated with the fans. I do think they were trying to make a quick buck, but I also understand their point of view. They were in a NHL, post-lockout NHL, where it was very hard for small market teams like the Islanders to be successful at all. Most teams were getting brand new arenas built by the local governments. They had the money to buy big superstars. The Islanders just didn't have that, and they were kind of cursed with their lease with Nassau Coliseum, and all of their dynasty players were gone. Al Arbour is on the way out, and they just don't have much money. Fans aren't coming anymore. A lot of fans had moved away or just gave up on the team. And I think it was a tough situation. They were kind of trying to do the best they could. It ended up being obviously the wrong move to make. But a lot of those moves also, like you mentioned, some of the trades, the Pierre Turgeon trade, if you look at those stats at the time, Turgeon was not doing all that hot for the Islanders. He had gotten obviously hit by Dale Hunter, infamously, and the Islanders sort of thought that had taken away a lot of his confidence in his game. And when they end up trading him, a lot of newspapers are hailing the Islanders, saying, you know, they got Kirk Muller. He's a winner. He's a veteran. He's a guy who comes to play every game, which ends up being a really bad choice of words, because then he doesn't show up for his first few games with the Islanders. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you had every reason to believe that that trade was actually going to work out for the Islanders. They also traded away Vladimir Malikov in that trade to get Matthew Schneider, and that actually ended up being a pretty good deal for them. Schneider became an all-star. Malikov had been tanking with the Islanders. So even if those guys went on to greater fame, they just were not working out at that time on the island. So it's a little bit difficult to look with 2020 hindsight and say, they shouldn't have traded Turgeon, because he just wasn't doing that well at the time.
Mm-hmm. Bring up Kirk Muller, and is it safe to say that the Muller situation with him, I guess, basically holding the franchise hostage because he didn't want to play there, is it safe to say that situation and also hurt the Islanders and not just the perception of the logo, but the perception of the franchise in general?
Oh, for sure. I think that a veteran player who was well-known, had some name recognition throughout the league, refusing to come to Long Island, sent a message that even if the Islanders tried to present it as, well, he was the captain in Montreal and he just doesn't want to leave the team that he captained, it was pretty clear that he didn't want to go to a losing team on Long Island. And rumors of how terrible the Coliseum were, you know, that was surfacing around the league. So I think that the Kirk Muller situation, if it had gone well, if he had come here all smiles and he works out for the Islanders, that would have been a big boost for that logo and the franchise. When he refuses to show up and then Turgeon and Malkov are immediately paying dividends in Montreal, and you have this guy making back page headlines for all the wrong reasons, it just really took a – I think it was kind of unfair for the Islanders and for Don Mahloney, because I think it's a pretty good deal at the time, and it really ended up sinking them.
Yeah, I mean, so many – there were so many things that just didn't fall the Islanders' way during this particular time. And I mean, you can go on and on and on. I mean, Milbury and Spano and all of these things. In general, I heard an interview with the guy who actually designed the logo, and I think it was Alan Hahn's book and Peter Botta's book, which is a great book as well. He said that he thinks if the team would have won more during that time, that maybe the logo wouldn't have the reputation that it had. Is that a fair assessment, or do you think it wouldn't have mattered because it angered the fans so much?
Right. I think you're referring to Ed O'Hara, who was the founder of SME, and I interviewed him for my book too. And yes, I think that if the team was winning, all of this kind of stuff falls away, right? You don't care so much about whether there's a leak in the Coliseum or whether the logo isn't the Heritage logo. Those things may still grate on you a little bit, sure, but they don't become the entire world to you. And all the focus isn't on the negatives. If that team goes to the playoffs, I'm not even going to say win a cup, but if they just go to the playoffs, I think everybody is kind of happy with it. And they may actually start liking that logo a lot more. Because if you look at that logo from a design standpoint, there's really not that much wrong with it. I mean, okay, it looks like the Gorton's Fishermen, there's that deal. But fishermen are associated with Long Island. You know, the type is really in your face, which is a big deal in the 90s. The colors were a different color scheme. A lot of fans today still like that lighthouse shoulder patch that they used. So, yeah, I think that people would have come to accept and probably even like those jerseys. And you could still bring back the original Islanders logo and use the fisherman as a third jersey. But because of all of that negativity and all of the losing, and not just that they were losing, but the way they were losing with Milbury at the helm, with Spano being outed as a con artist, with Muller refusing to show up to the team, this is not normal stuff. And I say in the book, the Islanders endured more in a 28-month span than most teams endure in 28 years. And I really think that's true of just the series of misfortune events that kind of struck them all at once.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very, very valid point, because it's amazing what we've had to endure as Islander fans just, you know, over the past 25 years or so. First 15 years of the franchise were great, but over the past 25 years, it's like, it seemed for a long time before we got Ledecky and Malkin in here, and, you know, with Lou Lamoriello coming in, we had no luck at all. It really felt like we were just, you know, the ugly redheaded stepchild of the NHL, and I think the Fisherman logo was definitely something that was one of the first to really enforce that kind of mentality, which I think still to this day, there's a lot of Islander fans that have this inferiority complex toward the rest of the league.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's because if you look at some of the teams that the Islanders are playing against, and this goes back to the question you asked me at the start, how did I become an Islanders fan? Well, because I just thought it's so crazy that little Long Island, suburban Long Island, is competing against Madison Square Garden and the Rangers, is competing against Los Angeles and Chicago and Boston, really? Uniondale is competing against those places? And I thought that's awesome, you know, that Long Island has its own team. I think that's great. But again, once finances became such a big part of the post-lockout NHL, and it was very difficult to control players long-term, I think the entire history of the Islanders after the last cup kind of shows they were unable to hold on to good players, and we just saw that this summer. But they also have just had an inability to attract good players, because who's going to come here when you can't afford to pay them, because you're not getting the kind of media coverage that teams in other big markets are. You're not getting the advertising dollars. And for a long time, they had this unbeneficial lease with the Coliseum where they weren't getting a good share of the parking revenue or the advertising revenue in the arena even. So when you have to share all of that and you don't own your own building, so it's not like the Islanders were getting any of the money from the concerts or the wrestling or the monster truck or whatever else is going on at the Coliseum, it's really tough to make a go of it. So I think that that's a few people that I was speaking to, including Brett Pickett, who is the son of John Pickett, the former Islanders owner, was saying a lot of fans don't realize that in the mid-90s, it was kind of a miracle that the Islanders even existed on Long Island anymore. And a lot of these guys that fall, you know, kind of under this criticism of they should have done better and they shouldn't have adopted this fisherman logo, they were just fighting like hell to keep the team in a place where it probably didn't belong anymore.
I'll tell you what, I still think it's miraculous that they're still here now. Because, yeah. I mean, even after, if you want to talk about even the era directly after the fisherman era, they were still a struggling team. It took until 2002 for them to even get back to the playoffs. So even, and you know, again, like I said, success has been, you know, parts and parcel for over the last 25 years. So I think even with all that they've gone through now, it's a miracle that they are still here.
Yeah. And I think it's great for the purity of sports that you have these neighborhoods on Long Island are represented by this team. And I think that's why when the Islanders won the Cups in the early 80s, it was so special because people really felt that they knew these players and they really represented them, and that it put Long Island on the map. It made people proud to be Long Islanders. Unfortunately, it just was unsustainable. And I think that was just market forces that started the decline. And then you do have bad ownerships because, let's face it, a lot of owners are going to want teams that you can make a quick payday on. And the Islanders just were never that kind of a team because of the market that they're in and the lack of media attention they're going to get, and because they didn't own their own arena. So that's kind of why they had these series of troubling owners and, you know, four owners that are in jail. Tom Croak from the Save the Islanders Coalition said, "We lead the league in convicted felons." And it's, you know, just a series of these bad events that I think are all just, it all goes back to money, as with most things, unfortunately.
Now, given the context, obviously we're talking about, you know, 90s NHL, and when you compare it today, I talked about, you know, Malkin and Ledecky. Even with Tavares leaving, the Islanders, are they in good hands? Do they really have a shot now? Do you think that they're now in a position where they can really actually compete?
I think as an Islanders fan, especially now that I've done so much research into their history in that era, It's hard to breathe and think, all right, now we can rest easy knowing that we have good ownership. Because so many times in their past, we've thought that before, only for it to all fall apart. And I'm not saying that there's any reason to be skeptical of the current Islanders owners. It seems like they're making a lot of headway, hiring Lou Lamoriello, getting Barry Trotz, Mitch Korn. I think a lot of, you know, that is positive, getting the new arena at Belmont, obviously. But I think Islanders fans should be skeptical in general of almost anybody in charge of the Islanders because of what they faced before. So until that arena is built and I'm at my first game at the Belmont Arena, and they've won a cup or they've been to the playoffs again or something, you're going to be skeptical. It's just the way that it has gone for this franchise for so long. And they still, right now, they don't have a superstar player. I mean, we think Barzal's developing into one for sure. But then, you know, there's a concern of, will you be able to keep him when he's a free agent? And so, you know, I think that they finally feel like they're in good hands. But I've got to say, looking at headlines from Newsday back when John Spano became owner, you see some of the very same sorts of headlines about, finally, we have somebody in charge who knows what he's doing, who has deep pockets, he's the real deal, and it all fall apart. Now, I have no reason to believe that's going to happen with these guys. I'm just saying let's have a healthy skepticism, because otherwise we may be in for another big dose of disappointment.
Mm-hmm. Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me about 50 times.
Exactly.
This is life as an Islander fan.
Exactly.
It's interesting that the book is coming out and during this time, because one of the big topics of conversation is that the Islanders are thinking about unveiling another third jersey. And one of the, at least on Twitter anyway, one of the big front runners from the fans is, yeah, let's bring the fisherman back. Is that something they should do ever?
I mean, why not? I think the problem with the fisherman when it first was unveiled, as we discussed, was that it was replacing the original logo. So they would obviously never entertain that again. They're not going to say, let's get rid of the Long Island map logo altogether and put the fisherman back on our jerseys. That would be a disaster. But to bring it back for 15, 20 games a season, I think it would be a hit with fans. A lot of the younger fans don't remember those mid-90s teams, so they don't have that association with it. Like, you know, the Dynasty era fans do. They don't have a negative association. They actually think, hey, the color scheme is kind of cool and it's different. And, you know, the Islanders really haven't had many different logos over their eras. So it's kind of cool to go back to something that evokes a prior time. And the fisherman represents Long Island. You know, right now it's tough to think because they're going through so much change about playing at Barclays and the Coliseum and now soon Belmont and losing their captain and superstar player. Getting a new Hall of Fame GM, there's just so much going on with the team that maybe this is not the best time to immediately rebrand. That might be something to do, you know, later on. But to have the fisherman jersey back for some games and even honor some of those players who wore it proudly, not the Kirk Mullers, but, you know, I think that, Ziggy Palfy would probably get a nice round of applause from the fans at Nassau Coliseum if he were to come back, and some of those guys. So, yeah, well, I think it's still a pretty neat-looking jersey. I have my Wendell Clark jersey proudly hanging in my closet, and I'll be wearing it to some book talks and signings, hopefully, in the next few months. And, a lot of fans are excited about it, so why not?
Wendell Clark, Wendy, I love that guy. I tell you, look at his restaurant up in suburban Toronto. He cooks a mean burger, I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
It's awesome. But interesting. I'm so many things. Every time you talk, so many things come to my head. You brought up Ziggy Palfy. Ziggy was the first Islander I remember rooting for, obviously, because I'm of that age, and he's one of the more, because of the era he played in, one of the more overlooked superstars in the history of the franchise. And obviously, even he eventually left because of the ownership difficulties and the failure to pay him. So, I mean, every time you think about everything that happened in that era, even Ziggy Palfy, the best thing that happened to the Islanders during that time, even he was a casualty of this total chaos that was affecting the franchise.
Yeah. I mean, it's crazy when you look back at their roster at that time, and I created a spreadsheet of all the guys who were on the team from 1995 to 1997, because I was going to try to track them all down. I made an attempt for every single one and spoke to a good number of them. But when you look at some of those names, you're like, wow, these are like a bunch of guys who either had been all-stars or became all-stars, whether it's Matthew Schneider, Travis Green, Darius Kasparaitis, Tommy Salo, Ziggy Palfy. These are some really top names in the league, but mostly known for things they did after they left the Islanders, because they got traded away. The Islanders couldn't afford them anymore, and they kept trying to rebuild and get more prospects or just make zany trades that Mike Milbury thought made sense and no one else did. Ziggy had some really great years with the team and was such a dynamic player, and watching some of those clips is really a joy to go back and see just the way that he could undress the opponents. Unfortunately, he's now remembered probably more for what he did with the Kings and so on. And I think that when he was on the Islanders, one of the key mistakes they made, which I describe in the book, is that they really didn't market him well. They marketed the team really as being first Brett Lindros's team, which is kind of scary to think about, and then being Mike Milbury's team, which is even scarier. And then finally, John Spano's team, which is the scariest of all. Those were the three guys throughout this fisherman era that they chose to be kind of the hallmarks, the standard bearers of the Islanders. And if you look at how misfortune befell Brett Lindros, I mean, that's no fault of his own, but unfortunately concussions forced him to end his career short. But the Islanders did really play him up as the quote-unquote better Lindros, as the GM Don Maloney said at the time, which is stupid. And, you know, he ended up having to retire, unfortunately, very young. But then with Milbury being so volatile and Spano being a criminal, those are not the guys you should have been promoting. And they always were reluctant to promote Ziggy Palfy. And, you know, some of it they said was because he was not a very consistent player and he couldn't speak English all that well. And so maybe he wouldn't be good on TV or in interviews. But from most of the stuff that I've seen of him, that he was a very charming guy and people thought he was kind of cool and people wore Ziggy Palfy wigs. And, you know, he just he has a kind of cool name and a lot of people liked him as a player. So it's kind of amazing that they didn't do as much as they could have to sell him.
Yeah. I mean, he was as good as anyone the Islanders, I think, have had, given the lack of talent around him. I mean, if he played on a good team, he would have scored 50 goals easily. Never scored 50 goals with the Islanders in a season. But I think if they put an actual team around him, I think he would have definitely scored at least 50 goals one season.
Yeah, well, if you look at, again, some of the line mates he had, some of those guys who were bouncing on and off that team, you know, if you had a team and they consistently kept some of these guys between Kenny Johnsen and Travis Green and Kasparaitis and Robert Reichel and Brian Smolinski, and a lot of those players were legit good NHL players, but they kept trading them. As soon as they got hot, they would trade them away or they would refuse to pay them what they were probably deserving. But it is sad to look back and think if they did have competent management, then maybe, even with all the financial difficulties they faced, maybe they would have been able to preserve a core of a team that could have made a little bit of noise in the playoffs. You know, and as you were saying earlier, they were only a few years removed from going to the conference final. So there was a reason why they made it then, and a lot of those players remained on the team. You know, they made the playoffs in 94, albeit they got swept. But they made the playoffs in 94, so a lot of those guys are still on the team in 95 and 96. So with some better coaching, with letting those guys grow up together, which they never did, I think you would have seen some different results.
Absolutely. I mean, there's so many different roads that this franchise could have gone down, and especially during the offseason when you have time to actually think about it and talking about my dad, it really makes your head spin. When you think about all of the different fates that could have befallen the Islanders, and then you think about the fates that actually have befallen the team, it really is nuts. I mean, this fan base has really been on a roller coaster ride that not many other NHL teams can relate to. And it's again, this is a fascinating era in Islanders history. And I mean, the Islanders are underserved in general as far as literature goes. And I really thank you for writing this book. When I promoted this tonight, I apologize for misspelling your name. I think it was Corey Hirsch. That was my mistake. But when I was promoting this tonight, I put up a bunch of pictures of Niles, and I wanted to ask you about Niles and how did he come about, and what was the deal with him? I mean, obviously he goes with the fisherman hole scheme, but he actually debuted the previous season, right?
Right, right. Yeah, Niles was actually the first element of the brand. So the Islanders, as far as I know, never had a mascot. And when they were adopting the new logo, the NHL told them, which was wise, don't think of it just as a new logo. Think of it as a whole new brand identity. What do you want people to think when they think New York Islanders? And so if we're going to go with this fisherman idea, then let's have a lot of maritime things going on in the game presentation, which they changed their goal horn to be more of like a fog horn. And have some like fog come through the arena with these fog machines, and also have a mascot that would embody that. So Niles debuted in that 1995 season, 94-95, although they didn't play games in 94 because of the lockout. But you have Niles being the first element of it, and he actually looked a lot different in the first year because he was this big rotund figure, and they later slimmed him down, essentially supposed to be an embodiment of the fisherman who would help sell merchandise, sell fans on this whole rebrand. Just something that you go into the stands and, you know, mascots can make kids happy, make you laugh. And I interviewed two different guys who played Niles in the mid-90s, and they talked about how they tried to do it, and I thought that was really interesting. And they, again, seemed to put their all into the character. It was just once it became associated with the fisherman, it was toxic, like everything else. So whether it was the players, you know, or the mascot, unfortunately, Niles bore the brunt of that, and he got beaten up in the stands and kicked and abused all the time. But it was a well-intentioned idea, again, of trying to have a holistic approach to branding.
I always thought it was cool that he had a working goal light on a helmet. That was one of the coolest things I've ever seen on a mascot.
Yeah, I think it's really cool. Although, so the funny story about that is I interviewed Rob DiFiore, who played the mascot. I say funny story, but it's also kind of a scary story. But he described that goal light you're describing that was on Niles's head was actually powered by a motorcycle battery that he wore in a fanny pack around his waist. And one time before he was heading out to the game, he was getting dressed up and the battery pack went on fire. And he started feeling this warmth on his body. And he's like, where is that coming from? And he's like quickly shedding the uniform and realizing that this thing went on fire. And then he asked for a raise because of this workplace hazard, and then promptly got fired as the mascot.
They fired him because his suit caught fire?
Well, I mean, it depends on who you ask, because Islanders management had other claims about actually he was asking for lots of other things like a full-time masseuse and all of these other perks that they were unwilling to give a part-time employee. But he says, and I kind of understand where he's coming from, that if you're going to be giving him this uniform that catches on fire, then maybe you deserve a little bit more money and you deserve health insurance. What do you say?
Absolutely. I'll tell you, that's a brave thing to go out and do to be any mascot, especially with the abuse that they take and all stuff. I mean, it's insane. I want to talk about the situation now. They're obviously going, the Islanders are currently playing games at the Coliseum next season. They're going back to the Coliseum. And I just want to know, again, we go back to it seems a little chaotic, and I think that the arena thing kind of adds to chaos. Is short-term, do you think it's a good idea? Is this something that the Islanders should definitely do? Obviously, everyone loves the Coliseum, the people who have memories of it and have been there for a long time enjoy. I certainly think I'll refer to it as my second home growing up. But is this something that that the Islanders can overcome and deal with? Or is this something maybe they should stay at the Barclays then maybe?
Well, I don't think there's any future for them in the Barclays Center. I think that was a doomed experiment from the beginning. The Barclays Center was built for basketball, not for hockey. The Islanders fans on Long Island were not really willing to travel into what they view as the city. You know, going into Brooklyn is a pretty big cultural change for a lot of them, even though it's technically on Long Island. And, you know, the sight lines are obscured in a lot of areas. The scoreboard is off kilter. There were so many problems with it from the beginning that I just didn't think it was going to work out, and it really hasn't. Now, I love Nassau Coliseum. It was the subject of my first ever book, and I just think it's an electric building, the atmosphere there for a playoff game. I was there for the Sean Bates penalty shot game in 2002. You were referencing that playoff run before. And just the way that building rocks. I mean, I was already an Islanders fan, but that just cemented it. I want to be part of this group of crazy people who are going wild for this penalty shot goal. I want to be part of this forever. And I just had so many great moments there, the playoff series versus the Penguins in 2013. And I'm happy to see them come back. I'm really excited. I have my Rock the Island plan for this upcoming season. So I'm looking forward to being at those games. I do kind of wonder what's going to happen because now they're going to be playing at the Coliseum for a while, and I wonder if the fans are going to get used to it and then be kind of sad when they move to Belmont because there's going to be all the nostalgia coming back and all the memories of the Islanders dynasty teams playing at the Coliseum and everything like that. So it may be a little bit difficult then to move, but I think it'll at least they'll be moving now to an arena that they own, and it'll be definitively on Long Island, not in Brooklyn. And it'll be built for hockey. So I think that they'll have a much more certified revenue stream for the future, and that'll all work out. But I mean, I love the fact that they're going back to the Coliseum. I wish they never left. That's to me a big part of the charm of the Islanders and Long Island and why I'm an Islanders fan. I mean, I just like that it's not Madison Square Garden. It's not the team of Wall Street. It's not in the middle of the city. It's kind of in the middle of nowhere, and yet still these fans come out of the woodwork from Long Island to support this team, and there's something just very pure about it that I've always loved as a fan.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. I do want to say, again, the first book is called Images of America, Nassau Coliseum, am I correct?
Yes, that's right.
I bought that, I think, the moment it came on sale.
Let me just say, I absolutely
love that book. It was fantastic. But more importantly, I want to say that my dad, who has been a fan since 1972, he loved the book as well. He thought it was absolutely fantastic. So I did want to pass that along to you because I let him read it, and he was just like, oh, my God, it's great. So I just thought you should know that.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I really, really appreciate it. I mean, especially when you do so much research on these books, and you know, for this We Want Fish Sticks book that's coming out in December, it was a dissertation. It took like, you know, 2 years of a lot of research and interviews and newspaper microfilm research and all this stuff, and I just kept thinking about those crowds at the Coliseum and the Islanders fans that I was trying to do it for, who, like you said, don't get a lot written about the team, unlike a lot of the other teams in our market that have tons of books. I mean, there's probably more books alone about the 1986 Mets than have ever been written about the Islanders. And that's just 1 year of one team. Granted, a great year when they did a lot of crazy things. And I love the Mets, but I think that the Islanders and Nassau Coliseum deserve it. And when I did the Coliseum book, I really thought that the history of that building is so special, not only having the dynasty era Islanders, but just having a tennis team that had Billie Jean King and Virginia Wade on it, having roller hockey and arena football with the New York Dragons, all of the amazing concerts that they had over the years. And that book has photos of Paul McCartney and Elvis, and pretty much any artist who was anybody from the 70s into the 90s played Nassau Coliseum at some point. And again, because it's in the shadow of Manhattan, just like the Islanders are in the shadow of the Rangers, it gets short shrift. And I always hated that about the Coliseum, because you look at its history and you're like, wait a second, there were all these really cool things here. And I know we're going to talk probably about wrestling a little later, and WrestleMania 2 in 1986 being at the Coliseum. So I just think that that's kind of like my role as a historian sometimes, is to bring that stuff to attention where no one's really thought to put it together before.
Absolutely. I mean, there's three of the four cups were won at the Coliseum. So much history just alone in the National Hockey League has happened in that building.
Yeah. I mean, if you look through that book, you know, when I look through it, I'm still kind of shocked, you know, about the amazing history of not just the hockey, but the boxing and the soccer team that they had, the New York Arrows, that won a bunch of championships. They had political campaign speeches by Nixon and Ford while they were presidents. And just like all these events that are so cool that, again, Long Island was on the national stage because of this building. And it's hard to imagine now with all of the talk about how the Coliseum had been dilapidated for so many years. But obviously, when it was built, it was state of the art, and people were coming out in droves. And a lot of people still know Nassau Coliseum from those Islanders championship teams. So the fact that people kind of dismiss it as just almost like this minor league arena, and it's kind of sad to see that that's what it had become over the last few years, you know, it really should be one of these great sports cathedrals. For me, it is. You know, when I walk in there, I just look up at the rafters and those banners with the championship teams and the retired numbers. Or, you know, you just walk around the concourse, and now in the new Coliseum, they put up some nice photographs in the hallways of different concerts and events that have been there. And you're like, yeah, you know, there is a lot of history here that we should be proud of and promoting.
I'll tell you, that's the type of reverence that I have. I have a reverence that Canadians hold for Maple Leaf Gardens or the Montreal Forum. I have that type of reverence for Nassau Coliseum, and it's just, whenever I would hear conversations from hockey people about the great arenas of the game, I would always say, how can you overlook the Coliseum? Because so many great things have happened at this arena. I mean, it definitely deserves its place in history.
For sure. And that's when I decided to write that book. I just couldn't believe it. Actually, I had a friend, Jason Antos, who wrote a book in that same series for Arcadia Publishing about Shea Stadium. And I love Shea Stadium, too, even though a lot of people refer to it as a dump. But I thought Shea Stadium was awesome. But even Shea, because the Mets play there, because it was in the city, got a lot more attention than Nassau Coliseum ever did. And I just couldn't stand that anymore. And when I was an undergraduate, I did my undergraduate studies at St. John's University in Queens. And I had an adjunct professor, Lance Elder, in the sports management program, who actually had been the general manager of Nassau Coliseum. And I didn't realize it, and I showed up for his course on the first day of classes, and he starts talking about his biography and telling us these stories about the Islanders and everything. I'm like, this is awesome. I mean, I'm going to have this guy throughout this whole semester is going to be telling stories about what it was like to work at Nassau Coliseum for 20 years. This is really cool. And he ended up writing the foreword to that book on the Coliseum. So, it's just a weird thing. I think that because it's kind of ingrained in my DNA, being from Queens, I grew up in Queens, and it was always the shadow of Manhattan, the underdog, no one wants to go out there. And then Long Island gets the same thing, like, oh, it's all the way far out there, nothing exciting happens out there. And, you know, people just don't know it that well, and so they dismiss it that way, which I kind of take umbrage with. And that's through a lot of my research. I've done a ton of research into the Islanders, not just those books, but I've done a lot of academic journal articles on it. And people ask me, like, why the Islanders? Why are you so interested in Nassau Coliseum and the Islanders? And it's because I just knew how special that place was going to some of those games. It was such a big part of my childhood. As, you know, I know you said it was for you and for your dad during the dynasty years. And it's something that I want to preserve for people. And unfortunately, you know, there'll be another generation of Islanders fans soon who'll never know what it was like to be at the Coliseum. And hopefully they have good memories in the new building. But, you know, it's important, I think, in my role as a historian to kind of document how special that stuff was and show Islanders fans, like, yeah, you do deserve books about your team, too. Like, it's a major league NHL team. Of course, we deserve a lot of attention.
Absolutely. The way I've always had it explained to me by my dad was that being an Islanders fan, first of all, you don't really understand it unless you are an Islanders fan, which, of course, I've learned the hard way over these couple of years. But also, he also explained it to me how the Islanders also kind of mirrored the people who live on Long Island when they first came into existence. They were always hard on their luck. They were in the shadow of New York City, and they were trying to always do good, and they were always trying to make a better life for themselves. And as the Islanders started to win, it was like the people of Long Island were win too. And when the Islanders were getting down, it was like the people of Long Island were, it seemed to always kind of mirror the, I don't want to say the exactly the life, but certainly they've always kind of mirrored the feelings and the ethos and the hopes and dreams of the people who live here. And I think that for people who have grown up in this region, that's where a lot of the attraction is, because there's so much self-identity in sports in general, not just the Islanders. I don't want to single them out for that. But there's so much self-identity with the team and Long Island that I think that's where, for a lot of people who to others may seem crazy, I think that's where that kind of lies.
Sure. I think exactly what you said, that kind of working class mentality and the fact that the Islanders, you know, since the Cup years, certainly have not had like one superstar player that, you know, they never really made a big free agent splash. They've gotten a few guys, but nothing like the other way other teams could spend. And they've just have kind of done a lot of reclamation projects, you know, a lot of guys who other teams discarded or didn't see the value in, and they built them into something, and these scrappy players and surprise players. And that's what makes it fun to me. It's not that fun to root for a team that you know is going to win every single year and that just has an unlimited expense account. I think it's kind of fun to be an Islanders fan, and it's very unpredictable and it can be very emotional and roller coaster, but I think it makes it all the sweeter when they do win. And having, you know, become an Islanders fan in 99 when they were in last place and they didn't really have a lot of hope on the horizon, and then when Charles Wong bought the team and they make the playoffs in 2002, and being in the building when Bates scores that goal, it just felt like all of, you know, those previous years of, you know, just the worst that you could possibly imagine in hockey were kind of being wiped away. And it's like, you know what, we now finally showed to the rest of the hockey world, like, we belong. And it made it so sweet. And the same thing, I'm sure, a lot of the fans felt when Tavares scored that goal against the Panthers, you know, at the Barclays Center to put them in the second round. It's just a part of being an Islanders fan that, yeah, we endure a lot of this turmoil and all of these terrible seasons. But then when they do have this turnaround, we're going to be hugging and screaming in the Coliseum or Barclays or Belmont or wherever. And it's going to feel all the better for it.
I hope you're right. I really do. I really do hope you're right. Right. One last question, and then I'll turn it over to Mike Larkin, who is I'm sure is coming at the bit to ask you some wrestling questions. Your next book is going to be about wrestling, I believe, right? I think that's what you told me.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't have any plans for any wrestling projects, actually. But I've sure have thought about it.
Okay.
So we'll see.
I did want to add, you brought up the Long Island Jaws. I did want to ask you about the Long Island Jaws, because I'm not only a big Islander fan, I'm a big Manon Raon fan. I love the RHI. I thought that was a really interesting league too. And the Long Island had a team playing in the Coliseum for 1 year, and then they just left. Did you find out when you were doing any of these projects about what happened with that, or why the Jaws stopped being in existence so fast?
I didn't really find out the exact reason why the Jaws went out of existence. From my understanding, though, this was something very typical of the Coliseum. They had a lot of teams, whether it was the soccer team, the tennis team. They had a ton of different lacrosse teams that came in and out. Most recently it was the Titans, but they had the Saints, and they had the Tomahawks was the original lacrosse team. They just had a lot of these teams that came in with these kinds of renegade upstart leagues that were trying to make a name for themselves, and they couldn't get into the premier buildings like the Garden necessarily. And so they would end up going to the Coliseum, like the second best. Well, it's still a legit arena. It's an NHL arena. But then the league would fizzle out, or the owner of the team would not have the finances. They wouldn't get the kind of attendance that they were hoping for, or hoping for some sort of a big TV deal that never came through. So that's kind of my understanding. I do look back and think it would be so cool if I could go back in time. It would be really fun to go to like a Long Island Jaws game and just see what the atmosphere was like. As a kid, I did get to go to one of the New York Saints games. I think it was in 99. And I'm glad I got to go, and I wish I went to more of them, but it was just kind of, you know, surreal to go to some place that you always associated with hockey and see it have like this lacrosse field out there. But unfortunately, again, they were a short-lived team, and that was just it's been kind of the history of the Coliseum. The Islanders were the only team to stay there for a really long time, right? Even the Nets left after a few years. And it's nice at least now to see the Islanders come back.
Absolutely. But it was also definitely a recurring theme that we always had these problems with the arena. I guess it always comes back to that, I guess.
Yeah.
So, Mike Larkin, you've been very quiet. Do you have anything that you want to ask our guest?
Absolutely. Well, I'll tell you right now, what's great about these platforms is we got to hear you tell your story, Nick, and it's been great just hearing you tell your story. You're an intelligent dude, and you're just a cool person all around. Now, you're a wrestling fan like myself, and you mentioned WrestleMania, too. You know, three venues, Los Angeles, I believe Illinois, and the Nassau Coliseum. Matches from that card, I mean, you look at Hulk Hogan and King Kong Bundy in the blue cage at the time for the WWF Championship. You think of Rowdy Roddy Piper and Mr. T in the boxing match. You think of Ozzy Osbourne was on the cover of in the corner of the British Bulldogs. There's so many great venues. I've been to many house shows at the Coliseum. My first ever SummerSlam was actually at the Coliseum, where Brock Lesnar beat The Rock for the Undisputed Championship, and Shawn Michaels, after a four-year absence from WrestleMania 14, defeated Triple H in a non-sanctioned matchup. So there's a lot of history as far as, you know, wrestling in the Coliseum as well. And if you'd even tie into hockey, you got Daniel Bryan with the S chance. So again, a lot of tie-ins there.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the Coliseum has a great history of wrestling that, as you say, it goes, I mean, even before obviously WrestleMania 2, they had some matches with all of the stars of the era, you know, WWF as it was at the time, now WWE, you know, they've constantly been coming through the Coliseum. I thought it was terrific to find out about that history of WrestleMania 2. I really didn't know much about it. And I contacted the WWE when I was doing the Nassau Coliseum book. And to their credit, and I'm an eternal fan of them, because they gave me a bunch of photographs free of charge to put in the book from all of these different events throughout the eras. And I've got Hulk Hogan at Nassau Coliseum. I've got a photo of, as you said, Rowdy Roddy Piper fighting Mr. T in the boxing match in 1986 of WrestleMania 2. I've got photos of Joan Rivers and Ray Charles at the Coliseum, yep, from WrestleMania 2. And just a bunch of other cool things. And I've been to a bunch of very interesting, you know, wrestling matches at the Coliseum, a bunch of house shows. I have tickets for WWE Evolution, the first all women's pay-per-view that's coming up this October at the Coliseum. And I'm really excited to see that. I think it's great that the Coliseum is still getting events of that caliber. But yeah, you know, wrestling is, with the passion of those Long Island fans, like you say, those yes chants for Daniel Bryan, mm-hmm, are just so cool. And yeah, there's just something that, about wrestling, that the fans bring their passion to it. It makes it really fun for everybody.
Now, I got
to
ask you about WWE Evolution, which we got coming up. Alexa Bliss versus Trish Stratus is going to be on that card. We're going to incorporate a lot of the women there. We got the Raw Women's Championship, the SmackDown Women's Championship, the NXT UK Women's Championship, the NXT Women's Championship, and the Mae Young Classic Final. I got to ask what those matches that are going to happen. Obviously, the one match announced with Alexa Bliss versus Trish Stratus, who has a pinnacle part as far as the Women's Evolution Revolution, as it's aptly titled there for the pay-per-view. You got to be excited to be seeing that live, Trish Stratus doing her thing.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I didn't even really start going to wrestling matches that much until fairly recently. I know, because I recently just found the program. I went to a wrestling match at Nassau Coliseum for my 10th birthday party in 1995. So I was there in November of 95, and recently I've made a bit of a project of, I've been going to all of these signings trying to get wrestlers to sign that card. So recently met with Kevin Nash and Hakushi and a bunch of the other guys who were on that card. Goldust, I actually saw him at Nassau Coliseum, and he signed the card there, which was cool. But then I really didn't follow wrestling all that much for a while, so I didn't get to see a lot of the women who, you know, like Trish Stratus or Lita or all these people who I'm hoping are going to be coming back for Evolution. So I'm excited just to see what that card is going to look like, because I really started following wrestling more closely in 2011. I was at an Islanders game and they advertised some wrestling event coming up, and I thought, oh, you know, that might be a fun thing to go to with you know, the family. And so went out there and just thought it was like a fun, good-natured time. You know, I know that it's fake. I, you know, I'm well aware of it. I just think it's kind of a fun thing in the world, and it's a, you know, it's a cool thing to enjoy. But yeah, I didn't get to see a lot of those people from the Attitude Era and all those. You know, I never saw Trish Stratus. I think it'll be awesome, and I love, you know, Alexa Bliss and a lot of those people from the current roster are really cool, and I've seen them many times. Of course, you're going to see Ronda Rousey is going to be, I would think, in the main event there, so it's going to be a good time.
Now, I got to say this. I mean, you mentioned, obviously, yeah, we all know business is fake. And you know what's so funny? Because actually, you remember Dr. D. David Schultz, who was on 2020? He's best known for slapping the bejesus out of John Stossel on 2020. So he just actually came out with a new book not too long ago. It's actually called Don't Call Me Fake, and how very apropos because of the old incident at hand. So I always get a chuckle, you know, when I hear about that, because instantly Dr. D. David Schultz just, you know, open hand slap, bada boom, right to John Stossel's face. And another thing I got to mention, man, we got October. It's going to be a hell of a month for wrestling. You got October 4th, MLW, Major League Wrestling's coming to Queens, New York. They're going to be doing the thing at the Melrose Ballroom. You got Impact Wrestling doing their thing at the Melrose Ballroom, Bound for Glory. Then you cap it off with Evolution. So October is going to be a plethora of wrestling up in New York.
Yeah, I mean, that's really exciting. I've been trying to go around to some of these different wrestling events. I just went to my first ROH show this summer. I'm probably going to be watching All In at a friend's place tomorrow night. There's, you know, and I think that the independents are really fun. I saw Billy Gunn at this independent show. I think it's called Northeast Wrestling, mm-hmm, NEW, like last month, actually. And yeah, I just, you know, it's a kind of a wholesome activity you could do with, you know, the whole family and just kind of laugh at it and think it's fun, but also admire the athletes. And as you say, you know, okay, so we may say it's fake, meaning that the matches are scripted.
Yeah, predetermined.
But they're still real injuries, right? Mm-hmm. This is still real athleticism. So that part of it is still exciting to see. And I just think it's a really fun way to kind of, you know, spend your time, especially in the hockey off season, you need to do something, right?
Correct.
So to go to some of those things, and I just went to SummerSlam at Barclays, which was really fun.
I got to ask.
Yeah, all that stuff.
Well, I got to ask you, man, because the big thing that came out of SummerSlam, obviously Ronda Rousey is the new Raw Women's Champion, beating Alexa Bliss in record time. We saw Roman Reigns take the championship off of Brock Lesnar. So I got to ask you, did you have a particular favorite matchup of the evening? Because I know it was a long evening, because you guys got the pre-show at 5, and then I think it ended around 11, so you guys were there for a long-ass time.
Yeah, it was a really long day. We were there for like 6 hours of wrestling, and that even tested my interest in wrestling. But seeing Ronda win the title, even though it was kind of a foregone conclusion, was just an awesome moment. Just to see her come out. I loved to see the pop that Seth Rollins got when he came out to start the main show. And I think, you know, just his story of coming back from injury is really cool. And he's just such a great worker. I think, Daniel Bryan and The Miz, seeing that matchup. And again, two really good workers. There's so much talent on that roster. They're almost like overloaded at this point. So it's almost hard to say there was like one match that was the number one. And of course seeing, you know, the main event actually ended up being almost like one of the lesser matches in a way, because of the way that it ended and everything. But they do just a great job with building up the drama and, you know, being a kind of tortured Islanders fan where you're used to going to games and you're going to be crying at the end because they're not going to do so hot, probably. It's kind of fun to go to a wrestling thing where, you know, at least at the end of it, they're going to try to make the fans happy in some way, or they're going to have, you know, you're going to get your mixture of some fun, you know, faces winning and some silly stuff going on. And, sometimes you just need to walk with Elias.
Oh, man. I dig Elias. He's got the EP out, you know, Walk with Elias. He's doing his thing. I also got to mention the CU as well, because you talk about King Kong Bundy, and, man, I saw those pictures. I still got that picture somewhere locked in New York Wrestling Connection. It was him and a wrestler by the name of Stockade against Spider and Tito Santana, two legends on that card. I still have that. I got to find those photos. But another legend is King Kong Bundy. You talk about WrestleMania 2. You talk about his match with The Undertaker at WrestleMania 11. Another guy's had his history. But, man, I saw that photo with Akushi, and I laughed because I still remember the matches with Bret Hart. A match with a young Matt Hardy before he was woken as an extra at the time. So I popped huge for the Akushi picture.
Well, you know what's really funny about that, too, is like I told you, I wasn't much of a wrestling fan in that period. So although I must have seen them on that night in 1995, I was not really, you know, knowing much about what was going on. I really didn't know those guys. And so now I'm discovering them all. And since I have the WWE Network, when I go out to see Hakushi or any of these folks, I kind of look up some of their matches and learn a little bit about them, which has been fun. And then interacting with them is really cool, too. You know, a lot of people, when you go to these signings, they bring just a pretty recent glossy photo or something. These guys are not used to someone coming in saying, I really love Nassau Coliseum and I have a card from my 1995 birthday. Will you sign it, please? And so when I show up there, a lot of them have been really nice, and they ask me a dozen questions about, where did you get this? When was this from? And with King Kong Bundy, who I met last month, was really funny because he didn't have much of a line because there were a lot of like some of the newer wrestlers who I guess, you know, the younger fans were there for. So I had a little bit of time to talk to him, and he was taking a close look at the card. And he was going over all the matches. He's like, oh, my God, there's Owen Hart, and there's, you know, Bret Hart is on this one, and Triple H when he was still Hunter Hearst Helmsley, and, you know, and he's going through everybody else. And then he's like, wait a second, I know you want me to sign this thing, but where's my name? And then I was like, you're actually all the way at the bottom where it says, like, also featuring, and then they mentioned, like, three guys. And he was actually the last one listed. And he's a bit of a comedian. Actually, like King Kong Bundy apparently has a second career as like a stand-up comedian. So he was cracking jokes and being like, oh, yeah, thanks a lot for like showing me this card where I'm like the last one billed on this event. It's really nice of you to bring it to me. But it was really fun to kind of do this with all these guys who, you know, they probably don't get to talk about that too much. And then they have all these memories of the people who are on there, and it's been kind of fun to relive, and for me again to discover this kind of stuff for the first time, because I don't really remember seeing them that night.
Actually, last thing I want to touch upon wrestling with you, because I know you're going Evolution. I hope you have a great time, man. And, you know, with the independent circuit, it's amazing what they're doing now. There's a lot of great promotions out there. Wrestling has had that resurgence again. And with the women as well, like we mentioned, you talk about New Japan Pro Wrestling, the companies in the UK, international. It's an international hotbed for a lot of talents that we get to see, you know, showcase their talents in the United States. But one thing I got to ask you about the MMA wrestling tie-in, because, you know, people talk about Ronda Rousey and Brock Lesnar doing their thing. Even CM Punk dwelled into some UFC not too long ago. I got to ask you, what do you think about the overall MMA wrestling tie-in? Because it doesn't even start with now. You even go back, you look at 90. You got Ken Shamrock. You got guys like Dan Severn. You got Tank Abbott, you know, who was also in there. He was also in WCW. So talk about the MMA wrestling tie-in, and what are your thoughts on the current day?
Yeah, I mean, and honestly, I don't really follow MMA that much. So, you know, obviously I knew about Ronda Rousey just because she's a pop culture phenomenon. But, you know, it seems like they bring in a little bit more of that authority, and someone like Brock Lesnar, when he's in the ring, you know that even though this is scripted, he's a legit athlete, right? I mean, and all these people are, don't get me wrong, but it adds that extra credibility of somebody who's actually competed in real unscripted competition. So it's fun to see them, and, you know, the power to them. I mean, you know, seeing Ronda, seeing Brock, they're two of the more exciting people, I think, on roster when they're there. I know that Ronda's going to bring in a bunch of her pals from MMA supposedly, and we're going to see them all debut soon. So yeah, I mean, it's fun. I just think they have so much talent on these rosters now. I kind of wondered if unfortunately some people get lost in it, and they call up some of these folks from NXT, and then that's kind of the last you hear of them. So you know, there's only room at the top for a few people, and unfortunately, you know, people like an Asuka or a Bayley or some of these others are going to get downplayed because of it. But hopefully, you know, they with something like Evolution, and if they start doing more, you know, all-female shows, that would be great. Just give them some more airtime, because I think that they're terrific athletes, and it'd be fun to see more of them.
100% agree. And you know what the thing is? NXT is just amazing at what it does. I'll say this right now. I like both shows, SummerSlam and NXT Weekend. But usually, once we get to those weekends, NXT, you know, just the volume's turned up. They're doing their thing. It's going to be very hard for the main roster cats to, you know, pretty much try to, like, fill, you know, their shoes and do their thing. But all in all, it was a great weekend for wrestling. And last thing I got to mention is All In. You mentioned All In. And, you know, you talked about Ronda, you know, the four horsewomen doing their thing in NXT. Got to ask you about All In. We got Cody Rhodes, the son of the late, great American Dream, Dusty Rhodes, the son of a plumber, baby, going against Nick Aldis, better known as Magnus, who we've seen in Impact Wrestling, NWA World's Heavyweight Champion on the line. Do you see Cody Rhodes following in the footsteps of his father and becoming the first ever second-generation NWA World's Heavyweight Champion?
You know, and here's the thing also is that I don't really honestly follow the independents all that much. I've just started to get into it a very little bit by going to my first ROH show this summer.
Yeah.
So I don't even, honestly know a lot about what's on that card, and I'll be discovering it. I mean, I did see Cody, and I know obviously that he's in that match. And I would think that they're going to give him the NWA championship because of the history, right? They got to give him that title, I would think. But yeah, I'm just, you know, kind of excited to see all of these people, because I don't get to see, you know, the Young Bucks that much. I don't see a lot of these guys in action. And I also kind of think it's fun to think of maybe the WWE having a little bit of competition here and there. And, you know, I don't know if this is going to develop into a WCW thing, and probably not. But just the fact that there are these different promotions that can travel to different parts of the country, because WWE can't be everywhere at once, and bring it to every town. And, you know, and I say this as somebody who just lived 3 years in Ohio, where we didn't get a lot of it. So being in New York, we kind of get spoiled because there's so many events coming through the Coliseum or the Garden or Prudential or wherever. But, you know, for those people who are living out near the Ohio-West Virginia border like I was, it's kind of like maybe once a year you get them coming through and it's a big event. So it's nice when these independents get stronger and then they have a better presence and they're willing to travel. And what Cody Rhodes has done, I just think, is astounding. He went from being, you know, he was obviously a legitimate, you know, very successful wrestler in WWE, but kind of fell out and wasn't doing too much exciting at the end. And then he goes to just this intelligent business plan of getting out there and uniting with all these other young upcoming wrestlers and new creative ideas, forging deals between ROH and New Japan, You know, it just makes for a very exciting product. And I'm always for underdogs. That's why I'm an Islanders fan. I will root for them just to kind of do good business.
And the last thing I could say of that, again, 100% agree. I dig what you're saying. But Ring of Honor, New Japan Pro Wrestling, going to be competing at MSG the same night as TakeOver next year, of Mania Weekend. What do you think about the competition with Ring of Honor, New Japan at the Garden? And then you got Mania Weekend in Brooklyn. So that's going to be an interesting night.
Yeah, it's really fun to see that kind of stuff play out. I mean, again, since I was not around during like the Monday Night Wars when WWF was going at it with WCW, I can't even imagine having that ability to like be channel surfing and just flipping back and forth. And competition always breeds good things for the consumer, right? I mean, so it's just another product for you to watch, and hopefully they don't, you know, hurt each other, but they complement each other. They offer different sorts of things, but it's just more of the product for you to enjoy. You know, look, we always have a lot of, like, difficult, rough things going on in our worlds. It's kind of nice to just settle down, you know, watch the network and throw on some sort of silly wrestling stuff every now and then and watch it. So I'm all for more of that content, and I just hope for the best for both of those brands.
Beautifully said, my friend. I'm going to turn it over to the host. Stevie, Nix, head him up. Go ahead.
Well, I will say that what we're really looking forward to next month, Mike Larkin, is the hockey season. I mean, that's really where it's at.
Okay.
So I just got to say, I had a great time. Nick, thank you for coming on with us. I really appreciate it. This is an excellent, excellent, fun time I had speaking with you. Can't wait till the book comes out. When does the book come out, I should ask?
Yeah, well, and thank you guys again. This was really fun, and I just love talking about this stuff, especially with fans who really – you know, live through it and know all that stuff. It's really cool. So, the We Want Fish Sticks book. So the formal title is We Want Fish Sticks, The Bizarre and Infamous Rebranding of the New York Islanders. Comes out through the University of Nebraska Press on December 1st. You can pre-order it already. It's up on Amazon if you look it up today. But December 1st is the official release date. I'm working on a whole bunch of book talks and signings throughout New York City and Long Island. So stay tuned. I'll be tweeting about all of those and hope to meet a lot of fans. It's just going to be hopefully a fun time, and I'll be able to share all these photos that I found of Niles and Ziggy. And yeah, we'll work in Mike Milbury and Kirk Muller too. And there'll be, just a bunch of stuff to, and I want to hear from these fans, you know, because I know a lot of people, you know, a lot of you guys lived it. You know, I wasn't even there for a lot of those games. So it's been really cool to see even like the photo that you shared on Instagram today of Niles. Like, I'd never seen that photo, and I thought that's really cool. Is that you, by the way? Was that a photo of you with Niles?
No, that was somebody else on Twitter. It was nice enough to share the photo with me.
Okay.
Credit to them.
Yeah. I just thought it was cool because I haven't seen, as I like to say, I haven't seen many photos of Niles in captivity. There's only been a few I've ever, like, seen of him. But, I just love talking to the fans about that. And, you know, you have to be a pretty passionate fan to have gone through the mid-90s Islanders and survived. So a lot of power to you, and I really hope that you enjoy the book and that it does justice to kind of what you experienced with that team.
Well, it helps that I was a kid and I really didn't fully understand what was going on. I think that also has a lot to do with it, because I had a dumb smile on my face when I wore that logo, and I think it would have been different if I was about 10 years older. But again, thank you so much for coming on. Can you give us your social media info where people can follow you and contact you and all that stuff?
Yeah, for sure. So on all social media, Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, everything, I am Nick Hirshon. So it's NickHirshon. So for sure, tweet at me, follow me. I love talking hockey or wrestling or whatever it is that you guys want to talk about. And I have a lot of these events that are going to be coming up kind of spontaneously. So I'll be sharing it. I even have a special video that I've created for the release of the book to kind of promote it. So that'll be coming out closer in November, closer to the release date. But that'll be the best way to, like, just, you know where I'm going to be and when we can kind of get together and talk hockey, and you can pick up a copy of the book if you want.
Wow. Wow. Thank you so much for coming on. Hey, listen, if you're ever at the Barclays Center or Coliseum, let me know. And, we'll meet up and say hi.
Yeah, for sure. I'd love to do that. I got that Rock the Island plan, so I'll be at 13 of the games at the Coliseum, I think it is, and 3 at the Barclays. So, yeah, for sure. We'll be in touch.
All All right. Thank you so much for coming on, Nick. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Appreciate it.